Right. This is week 14. It's actually the second week we're dealing with the idea of covenanting and conferring obligations. So ordinance of covenanting, covenanting confers obligation, part two. Fourth term of communion, public social covenanting, is an ordinance of God obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament. So, we're going to be looking at social covenanting and the obligation it confers. And while I'm not going to be constantly harping on how it differs from personal covenanting, we do need to keep in mind that the nature of the obligation conferred in social covenanting is in many respects different, simply based upon the fact that a corporate social person, like a church or a nation, is by its very nature going to exist over numerous generations. So that if a covenant has provisions or has ends contemplated, some sort of goal in mind that cannot or is not accomplished within the generation making the covenant, that these obligations descend. And they descend from generation to generation. Now, we're going to talk about that in a bit more detail, but it's an important point. Covenants remain in effect as long as the parties that have entered into the covenant remain. So with covenant of marriage, the death of one party dissolves that covenant. But it does not, the death of individuals in a corporate person does not present, even if it's the majority, doesn't present the condition that would absolve or dissolve covenant obligation. Because a corporate person is persistent in subsequent generations. And so as we talk about this stuff, we really only have one question that we're going to examine tonight, but it's relatively involved. And as we look at the idea of obligation being conferred through social covenanting and why and so on, we should continually, at least in the back of our minds, be able to contrast a lot of what we're going to say with personal covenanting. Personal covenanting is by its very nature limited to the individual or individuals who are doing that. Right? Social covenanting involves all of the individual persons composing the corporate person. Again, whether we're talking about church or state. And we're not going to get into every aspect of it. The things we don't cover this week, Lord willing, we're going to try to... I want to tie this up next time. All the ends that we're going to leave a little loose around the edges tonight. So I want to focus on this main or major central idea of the obligations that are conferred through social covenanting. But again, some of the differences between personal covenanting and social covenanting are, in fact, things that require us to consider them under different headings and matters. It's precisely because social covenanting involves or potentially involves not only subsequent generations, but possibly subsequent generations to the end of time. Because of that, we have to consider this obligation as what is called a descending obligation. It's not simply the obligation of a generation or a particular church or nation in a generation. It's an obligation which embraces a present generation and has the power to bind subsequent generations. So we're going to look at some of why that can be. As I say, when we discuss it further next time, we're going to try to tie all of this up. A lot of the points we're going to get into tonight, we want to try to tie it all up and make it into a little bit more of a neat package before we move on to the next topic. But descending obligation of covenants is an extremely important topic because it has tremendous bearing and direct bearing on our view of the national covenant and its relation to the church or the relation to the nation of Scotland. Our views of the Solemn Ligon Covenant and its relation to the churches of the three kingdoms, England, Scotland, and Ireland, as well as its obligations upon the all that have descended ecclesiastically and nationally from those kingdoms. So we need to consider this this topic, and I want to try to help you fix a lot of this in your mind. You know, you need to have this fixed in your mind, and hopefully by the time we get through tonight and next week, you'll have a pretty good and firm grasp of this idea of both covenanting, conferring obligation, as well as the descending nature of that obligation. These are important questions because these are the questions that have been determinative as to why we are Presbyterian in the way that we are, Reformed Presbyterian, and not some other flavor of Presbyterianism or open to some reconfiguration of Presbyterianism like Presbyterianism du jour. You know, we don't want to encourage that, and there's a reason for that. So we need to understand why why principles are important, and we've dealt with that from a doctrinal point of view in other under other considerations in other series that I've tried to cover, just going through our confession and catechisms. But why these things are important and transmissible and binding, that's what we're talking about now. You know, why can't we just go back and sort of pick and choose what we want to pick and choose? Well, we need to understand that our doctrinal standards are, in fact, the products of covenant obligation, a pursuit of covenant obligation. And so understanding then this idea that we're talking about, that we started talking about last time, we'll be talking about tonight and Lord willing, next week, understanding that will take you a long way toward understanding why most of these undertakings by people, where they think that they're going to be more ecumenical or more precise, are just so many permutations of covenant breaking. They're not really advancing the church in doing it. They're bringing together more people who are perhaps entering under an obligation they don't understand, but it's an obligation nonetheless they will be responsible to fulfill. Now, I'm not going to get into that tonight, but next time we'll be talking about that in a little bit more detail. A lawful covenant, just in short, again, we're not going to get into the defense of this tonight, but a lawful covenant, once taken, cannot be abandoned without provoking divine judgment. And it's not in the power of anyone to dissolve a lawful covenant. The ends that are covenanted must be fulfilled. The only other choice you have is to be branded a covenant breaker by God and by history. And that has very serious consequences in history and on Judgment Day. So, let's begin looking at question one then, which is, again, our only question tonight. How does social covenanting confer obligation, and in what way is it different from personal covenanting? So, this is a big answer, and then we're going to dissect it. Social covenanting entails obligation on the covenanting society, even throughout its existence, until the end of the covenant be attained. Look at Genesis 50, 24 and 25.
Genesis 50, verses 24 and 25. And Joseph said unto his brethren, I die, and God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land unto the land which he sware to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath of the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones from hence.
So Joseph, when he knows he's dying, he tells the children of Israel, I know God is going to deliver you from Egypt. Now, if you ask how he knows this, it's already figured to him when God makes a covenant with Abraham. We're going to be looking at that in a little while. But it's already there. They were already told from the time of Abraham that this was going to happen. Joseph is a man of faith. He understands the covenant. God has opened the secret of the covenant to him so that he understands they're going to be delivered. And he says, look, when you're delivered, I don't want my bones to remain in Egypt. Bury me in the promised land. And he makes them swear an oath. Now, as we're going to see, that oath is, in fact, binding upon them so that when they leave, some hundreds of years later, the first thing that Moses does to prepare for leaving Egypt is to get Joseph's bones on a wagon to get them out of there. The covenant obligation descends until a generation comes that can fulfill it. Right? Once they fulfilled it, that particular covenant will no longer be binding because the duty covenanted has been fulfilled. Some things which the church covenants have been fulfilled. Some things have not. Some things remain binding precisely because the church, which made the covenant, and the God with whom the covenant has been made are the two parties, and both remain. So as long as there is a church descending from the Church of Scotland, for example, to make application, so long will these obligations, these covenant obligations that were undertaken by that church, remain. And it doesn't stand in the power of anyone to absolve others from performing their duties that have been covenanted, nor does anyone have the power to dissolve the obligation that has been engaged. Now, the reason for this is severalfold. First of all, because such covenants are made not merely in the name of the individuals who enter into them, but also in the name of posterity. So, for example, look at Jeremiah 11:10.
Jeremiah 11:10. They are turned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words, and they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers.
Yeah, they've broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. In other words, what? God says that covenant that was made by your ancestors, that covenant right there is the one that you've broken. Now, the fact that he's saying that you broke it implies that there was an obligation, even though it was done by your ancestors. On recorded occasions of warranted covenanting, such was the manner of entering into the engagements made. That is, to take in not only the present generation, but posterity. Look at Deuteronomy 29:14-15.
Deuteronomy 29:14-15. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day.
And also with him who is not here with us this day. In other words, it's looking beyond. It's looking beyond, as we'll see, to subsequent generations of those born within the church or nation, as well as any who might subsequently join themselves to the church and nation. However, it may be necessary to add the explanation that by those who are represented as not present, we are to understand the descendants of the congregation of Israel, since the reference to the duties then performed by the assembled people speaks of them. Deuteronomy 30, verse 19.
Deuteronomy 30, verse 19. I call heaven and earth to record this day against you, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both thou and thy seed may live.
Yeah, so in case you think that I was just making it up, that those who are not present were talking about the posterity in Deuteronomy 30, verse 19, it comes very clear that the thrust of this this covenant engagement is binding not only the generation entering into it, but it is contemplating and binding subsequent generations. This is why the Bible again and again speaks in terms like this. It will say something is to thee and to thy seed. Because there's a continual assumption that the actions of a former generation may lawfully bind subsequent generations. And you might say that doesn't seem fair, doesn't seem just, but if we remember what we talked about with the covenant of works, for example, all mankind was in some sense reckoned in Adam. In the covenant of grace, all the elect are reckoned in Christ. Just in the common affairs of life, decisions your parents have made, situations that they have found themselves in have affected you. You don't come into the world without any connections. You don't remain in the world without any connections. Right? Everyone has a rooting in the past. And that rooting in the past, even if you're adopted, right, the family adopting you, what they've done or haven't done will largely shape your life. So this principle is all around us. We live in it. And so if it's not fair, that's really a big problem for all of us, because it's what we're all dealing with. It is the way God has ordained it. And so, if you really think it's not fair, maybe on Judgment Day you can try to bring that up, but I wouldn't if I were you. God has ordained it. I suspect that it's not something to be readily argued against, but anyway. Hence, whatever in consequence of entering into such federal engagements is incumbent on those who make them, is also binding on their successors. Look at Jeremiah 32:39.
Jeremiah 32, verse 39, and they shall be my, and I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever, for the good of them and their children after them.
For the good of them and for their children after them. But the fact is that this arrangement, were it not for our sinful estate, this arrangement is actually designed for our benefit. Right. Man has perverted that through sin. But if things were different, if we lived in a sinless world, you would see very clearly the benefit of this arrangement. It's a beneficial arrangement. And the benefit of the arrangement is actually made firm and made clear to the elect. You're not receiving what you deserve in Christ. You're receiving what he deserves. And so you're benefiting from what another has done who's gone before you in the person of our Savior. Right. Since a covenant transaction binds the parties to the making of it, therefore binds all those, though not present, whom these parties represent and for whom it is made. Give Deuteronomy 5, 2 and 3.
Deuteronomy 5, 2 and 3. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day.
So whatever reason the transaction affords for binding the former, it supplies for holding the latter bound as well. Genesis 17:7.
Genesis 17:7, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee in their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee and to thy seed after thee.
The engagement then made by and for the living covenanters is not less explicit than that thereby made for them, made by them, for those who shall succeed to their privileges and duties, and the latter no less than the former are brought under its obligation. In other words, when succeeding generations are entering the scene, they not only receive the duties set before them, but they are also partakers of the privileges that are bound up in that covenant as well. It's both. And so there is a great benefit for those who are faithful, and that brings you under an obligation. In Exodus 19:5-8.
Exodus 19:5-8. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. And Moses came and called for the elders of the people, and laid before their faces all these words which the Lord commanded him. And the people answered together and said, all that the Lord hath spoken we will do. And Moses returned the words of the people unto the Lord.
Right, so the federal compact could not be made without constituting an obligation. You can't have a covenant without an obligation. Nor could it be entered into without conferring that obligation on all the parties represented at its formation. So, all parties represented in those who enter into the covenant are also bound by the obligations of the covenant. This is very basically, this is the rationale behind infant baptism. It is, in fact, historically speaking, and we're going to talk about this more next time, probably a little bit more anyway, it is the foundation of the stability of nations and their ability to interact with one another. You can't make a treaty and then have a generation die off and have the treaty dissolve because one generation dies. So everyone has to be taken into that obligation who would be contemplated in that. We're going to look at Deuteronomy 29:10-15.
Deuteronomy 29:15. Ye stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders, and your officers with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day.
Okay, so again, it is the nature of a social covenant that it involves not merely individuals who enter into them, but the bodies, whether ecclesiastical or national, civil, political. It represents all who pertain to those bodies, not only at the time of the making of the covenant, but it's an obligation which descends upon subsequent generations, because subsequent generations, they constitute the same body in the same way that, you know, cells in your body are constantly dying and new ones come into place. It's still the same body. All right, second consideration here, and this has to do, again, with why there is this obligation. The church is one in all ages. Look at Song of Solomon 6:9.
Song of Solomon 6:9. My dove, my undefiled, is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughter saw her and blessed her. Yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her.
So the church, the true church of Christ, is one yesterday, today, and forever. Just there aren't two true churches or three true churches. There's one true church of Christ. And the reason is, her glorious head is one. Ephesians 4:15.
Ephesians 4:15. But speaking the truth in love, may grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ.
In fact, we know that all her true members are spiritually united to him.
Ephesians 4:16. Ephesians 4:16. From whom the whole body fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working in the measure of every part, make it increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love.
And we know that they're united to one another. They're united to one another in love as well. Colossians 2:2.
That their hearts may be comforted, being knit together in love, and unto all riches of the full assurance of understanding, to the acknowledgement of the mystery of God and of the Father and of Christ.
So what we're talking about here is this what we call it, a mystical union. But again, the church is one because the head is one. The body unto which all the members belong is one. The spirit that is knitting together that body is one. There is a single love that is working in that body toward one another and toward Christ and the truth. It's such that the church consists not in a limited number of those who at any time fear God, but of all of them. Acts 2:47.
Acts 2:47. Praising God and having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved.
when we talk about this, what we need to remember is we talk about the church being one. We're not simply talking about the church at this time or that time. We're talking about the church throughout all times, from the beginning of history until the end of time. That church constitutes one body. Is one body enduring from generation to generation by her Lord, then she's spoken of and is recognized by her members, which is the truth seen in the commission given to Jeremiah in Jeremiah 2, 2, 3, and 20.
Jeremiah 2, verses 2 and 3. Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, Thus saith the Lord, I remember thee, the kindness of thy youth, the love of thine espousals, when thou wentest after me in the wilderness, in a land that was not sown. Israel was holiness unto the Lord, and the firstfruits of his increase. All that devour him shall offend. Evil shall come upon them, saith the Lord. Verse 20. For of old time I have broken thy yoke and burst thy bands, and thou saidest, I will not transgress, when upon every high hill and under every green tree thou wanderest, playing the harlot.
Yeah, so, when Jeremiah is speaking, he's speaking to the church as a single body which endures from generation to generation. A single body that is durable or persistent. There is a single corporate person here, which is the church. And this is confirmed, this notion of one body is confirmed by the psalmist who taught the church to sing long after her deliverance from Egypt in the first person. I want you to look at this. It's actually very interesting. Look at Psalm 66:6.
Psalm 66, verse 6. He turned the sea into dry land. They went through the flood on foot. There did we rejoice in him.
Yeah, the psalmist is singing, there did we rejoice in him. This is many, many years later, right, after the deliverance from Egypt. And yet, there's a sense in which what the psalmist is saying is this. When Israel rejoiced being brought out of Egypt, being brought through the Red Sea, there's a sense in which we, who now occupy the historical reality of the church, right? We're the living generation, we are somehow rejoicing with them at that time. You know, we rejoiced with them. And we need to recognize that we, in a very real sense, we had to rejoice with them. Right? Because the obligations were obligations descending to us. The mercies were toward us. And the duties as well descend to us. But the reason we are where we are is because they were delivered at that time. So our rejoicing is very much intimately tied with their deliverance. So much so that we can say that when the body in that generation was delivered, we were delivered. And there's a sense in which they could, had they looked forward, and they do at times look forward, they could say, we rejoice in our deliverance, but so do all of our descendants. So, when we say the church is one in all ages, we have to understand that this mystical oneness involves us in a unity which makes us in some sense in present communion with all who were or will be in the communion of this one church, even though as the present generation we're the only generation that are living as this one church. Right? We're representing the body at this moment in time. Moreover, the church posterior to the advent of Christ is represented as the house in which Moses served, but which Christ had built, and over which, as well in the days of patriarchs as in the last times, he ruled as a son. So look at Hebrews 3, 2 and 6.
Hebrews 3, verse 2, who was faithful to him that appointed him, as also Moses was faithful in all his house. And also verse 6, but Christ as a son over his own house, whose house are we, if we hold fast the confidence and the rejoicing of the hope firm unto the end.
And it is to the church, as existing in all times, that unquestionably belongs the apostolic description found in Ephesians 5, 25 to 27.
Ephesians 5, 25 to 27. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish.
So, the description of the church, the holiness of the church described, is not something limited to one time or one place, but everywhere the church is, at all times and at all places, it is, in fact, characterized by this holiness. Now, what this means is something very interesting, again, to contemplate. The church is holy. The church is holy, but at any given time, individual members are only more or less holy. What this means is then the church as is a body, church as a body, has a standing independent of the individual members who may be in her communion. So the church is an independent body in our contemplation than any single individual member who might be in her communion. The church is holy. Are you holy? More or less. But the church is holy. So there is this corporate personal identity that can be characterized as holy, which indicates to us that there is a standing independent of individual members. To see this a little more clearly, I want to look at Isaiah 62, verses 3 and 12, and compare them with 1 Corinthians 5, 1.
Isaiah 62, verse 3, thou shalt also be a crown of glory in the hand of the Lord, and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. And verse 12, and they shall call them the holy people, the redeemed of the Lord, and thou shalt be called sought out, a city not forsaken. 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. It is reported commonly that there is fornication among you, and such fornication as is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife.
So, as a corporate entity, a corporate person, the church can be a crown, a royal diadem in the hand of the Lord. And holy. And yet, at the same time, there can be members who are not only less holy, but even perhaps more sinful. That tells us that we have to distinguish them and understand that there are different ways of contemplating the church. And when we're talking about public social covenanting, we're talking about contemplating the church in that character where the church is holy. And again, let me just say before we move on a little bit further here, the very confession the church is holy tells us the church, the true church, can't break a lawful covenant. Right? Members of the church may be covenant breakers, but they can't ever be the church. To the extent that we approximate the true character of the church, we stand in a relation to the corporate body that makes us indistinguishable from that corporate body. Again, this is why once covenants have been made, it's important that we keep them.
Is this a reference to the visible or the invisible church? Because the visible church is those who confess the truth and their children. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the moment you stop confessing the truth, you show yourself to be a hypocrite, and you were never part of the invisible church, certainly. So the corporate person is that...
But the visible church, to the extent that the visible church is approximating the invisible church, it's going to be more or less pure.
Against that standard of the invisible church, you're saying?
Correct. But that...
So the invisible church is the holy church, which will never break covenant. The visible church is...
Visible churches can and do break covenant. But it is of the character in the visible church to be faithful is not to break covenant.
Right.
So this church as a responsible agent, even as an individual, she may come under obligation and fulfill it. Look at Isaiah 54:5.
Isaiah 54:5. For thy maker is thine husband, the Lord of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth shall he be called.
And through every age of her existence, the church may be held bound to duty by her engagements. Psalm 56:12.
Psalm 56:12. Thy vows are upon me, O God, I render praises unto thee.
So, as the church comes under obligations, the visible church, to the extent that she lives up to those obligations, she's in fact reflective of the invisible church. To the extent that she departs from it, she not only departs from the invisible church, but she departs from the character of the visible church. There's a declining from the profession of the true religion. The same principle which is applicable to the church as a whole behooves to be contemplated by every section of her in given circumstances. So, again, this is just, all we're saying is this. If it's a moral principle that it behooves the church as a whole, we think of the universal visible church, Catholic visible church, behooves the whole, then it certainly behooves the sections of it. whether we contemplate that as particular churches or congregations, they too are bound, or should be contemplated as binding themselves in given circumstances. So we recognize different circumstances from particular church to particular church, but within those circumstances, you know, moral duties are persistent, and the objects for which the church covenants ought to be the more perfect fulfillment of moral duties to God. And so what's applicable to the whole in general is certainly applicable to every particular manifestation. Look at Acts 15:23 and 2 Corinthians 11:2.
Acts 15, verse 23, "And they wrote letters by them after this manner. The apostles and elders and brethren send greeting unto the brethren which are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia."
2 Corinthians 11, verse 2, "For I am jealous over you with godly jealousy, for I have espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ."
So in the Council of Acts, what are they doing? The Council of Jerusalem in Acts 15. Well, they solve a problem, and it's biblical, and so this is really, it's biblical. They've engaged, their engagement suggests that this is something that is applicable to the church as a whole, therefore it's applicable to all the parts or particular churches, and so they send a letter and say, look, this is what we've done. You should too. And in Acts 16, we see that as they go about telling them what they've done, the churches do begin to sign on to that. And likewise, when Paul is talking to the Corinthians, he says, look, it's the duty of the church to be chaste or holy. And that's something which pertains to the whole. And I have that hope for you too, right? As a particular church. All right, let's move on to the third consideration here for conferring obligation because of the church's social character, wherein members enjoy privileges not merely in their individual, but also their social capacity. So they also are both called to duty. Revelation 2, 5.
Revelation 2, verse 5. "Remember therefore from whence thou art fallen, and repent, and do the first works, or else I will come unto thee quickly, and will remove thy candlestick out of his place, except thou repent."
Yeah, why does social covenanting confer obligation to descending generations? Well, because due to the church's social character, members enjoy their privileges in the church not simply as individuals, but as members of a society. Right, so there's a sense in which what everyone does affects everyone else. What people refuse to do also affects everyone else. You see the same thing in nation states. You know, when people behave in one manner, it can be good. And when they behave in another manner, it can be bad. Right, so the social character already is telling us that there is or should be understood to be a conferring of obligation, not simply to the individuals making the compact or the covenant, but to all who are contemplated in that. You know, in national terms, you know, if your country engages in diplomacy, and they do well, then you get to live in peace, and if they fare poorly, you're probably going to end up in war. There's a similar similar thing that we can contemplate of churches as well. All right, the actions of an individual are not those of any society to which he may belong, except he act for them and according to their appointment. Hence the warning in 1 Timothy 5:22.
1 Timothy 5:22. Lay hands suddenly on no man, neither be partaker of other men's sins. Keep thyself pure.
Yeah, lay hands on no man suddenly. Why? Because you don't want to be a partaker of their sins. So when a society appoints someone to act for them, that represents the society. But individuals in their actions do not necessarily represent the society. Unless a society consents, unless a society in fact appoints them to work in that capacity. So, again, what a society does, conversely, we can say, represents the individual. We're going to see this as we proceed, unless the individual explicitly dissents from that. Right, there's a presumption that society represents the individuals in that society. That presumption does not work in the other direction. Right? The presumption is not that the actions of an individual represent the society unless the society either consents by giving legal standing to what is being done, or they appoint such and such a person to represent them in their acting. That, by the way, is one big reason why Reformed Presbyterians have been so adamant about political dissent, not serving in oath-bound offices or positions, not entering into voluntary associations and cooperations with other bodies or groups. Because by doing so, you're not simply consenting to a particular course of action, but you're consenting to that body in its acting. And that involves you in more than just a single purpose. So the deeds of a society are those of every member thereof who does not disapprove of them. Look at Revelation 2:20.
Revelation 2, verse 20. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, which called herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols.
Yeah, so why do we have to dissent? Why can't we take an oath of allegiance? Why can't we serve in the military? It's not because there's something inherently wrong with being in the military. We're not knee-jerk pacifists. But there probably is going to be an unjust exercise by an immoral government. We have to dissent to show our disapproval. Because if we don't, we're culpable for the deeds of the society. You know, the fact that nobody is calling Jezebel out. Right? Christ says, I have something against you for that. So you have to disapprove of them and of everyone who, because of these deeds, does not leave the communion. So look at Revelation 18:4.
Revelation 18, verse 4. And I heard another voice voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues."
Yeah, this has become a problem now. You know, we can't take oaths of citizenship. Right? We can't do that. We can't. Join in or homologate corrupt churches or corrupt groups. Right? We have to come out of them. We have to leave the communion. We can't do that. If we do, we will be held guilty before God for the same reasons they are guilty before God. We're not to enter into this kind of... You don't just enter a group. You join a corporate person. You're joining a corporate person. And that corporate person is under the judgment of God. And if they're unfaithful to the trust, if they're unfaithful to God, if they are faithless in their duties, then the only way to avoid falling under the divine judgment, the only way to remain with a clear conscience on judgment day, is we have to come out of these associations. We can't join a corrupt church in order to reform it. Can't do that. You join the corrupt church, you are immediately condemned before God. You stand condemned. You can't have a clear conscience, so nothing you do in that connection will be conscientiously upright before God. It can't be. That's why you can never reform something from within. It reaches when the corporate personality changes, it just doesn't happen this way. Duty of the church to exercise a prophetic voice, to stand outside of the corruption and tell people what to do. Because they can't, once you're in it, you can't see what you need to do. The engagements of society are understood to be acceded to by every member of it existing when these are made, and of everyone who may become connected with it before they are fulfilled. Get Exodus 12:48.
Exodus 12:48. And when a stranger shall sojourn with thee, and will keep the Passover to the Lord, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it, and he shall be as one that is born in the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat thereof.
Yeah, so when a society comes under engagements, everyone who accedes to the society comes under like engagements. Okay, you enter that society, you come under those engagements. And you can't escape them. You can't say, never mind. We'll get into this later, but you can't second guess. You know, once you've taken upon yourself that obligation, you've owned it, and now on judgment day, you're not only going to be, as we'll see, not only will you be found to be not dutiful, you'll be found to be not faithful. The guilt is much more severe. Everyone who joins a society is understood by his act of joining it to approve of its organization, to accept its privileges, and become engaged to its duties. Numbers 9:14.
Numbers 9:14. And if a stranger shall sojourn among you, and will keep the Passover unto the Lord, according to the ordinance of the Passover, and according to the manner thereof, so shall he do. Ye shall have one ordinance, both for him, both for the stranger, and for him that was born in the land.
So, joining a society is understood, it's understood that there's an approval of the organization, as well as an accepting of both privileges and engaging to the duties. So they're privileges, but they're duties. Right? It's not, you know, it's not all one of one character. You have privileges, but you also have duties that come with that. It would be impossible for society to continue were obligation to cease so soon as the individuals who may have come under it should leave it, whether it's by death or otherwise. Look at Numbers 36:7.
Numbers 36:7. So shall not the inheritance of the tribe of the children of Israel remove from tribe to tribe. For every one of the children of Israel shall keep himself to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers.
Right. Why is it that the laws of Moses are concerned about inheritance? Inheritance is something that presumes a persistence of privilege and duty. Right? The death of someone doesn't end the corporate person. Someone leaving does not end the corporate person. By the way, you know, leaving other than by death doesn't actually absolve you from covenant duty. Right? If it was lawful, if it was in fact, you know, a moral principle, you can't leave and go somewhere else and say, well, by leaving I'm no longer under that obligation. The obligation is there. You just may not have the society around you that's going to nag you to fulfill the obligation. That's not a good thing, by the way. It's not a good thing to be left to your own devices, because usually when people want to be left to themselves, they want to be left to their own devices, it's because they are in a state of backsliding and or apostasy. Right. Were the duties of social bodies to cease in this manner, it might be held these communities should be reconstructed on the death of every individual member of them, and also on the accession of each one who might be connected with them. In other words, if your birth or death, coming or going, if that somehow changed the character of the corporate person, then every person's coming or going, whether by death or accession or depart, you know, apostasy, whatever, each time a new person either showed up or left, you would have to rewrite the whole social compact. The whole covenant would have to be redone so that the people who now represent as living, the living, present, living generation, they all are present and so on. Well, it's just foolishness. It doesn't work that way. Look at Ruth 1:14-16.
Ruth 1:14-16. Verse 14. And they lifted up their voice and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And verse 16. And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God.
Yeah, Ruth is acceding to the church and people of God. Israel's not going to rewrite their constitution because Ruth is now joined, any more than they're going to, or did rewrite their constitution, say, when Moses died. It doesn't happen that way. Social bodies, social corporate persons, have a persistence in history. And that remains intact with all of its duties and privileges. All of its obligations and promises. They remain bound up together with the corporate social person. Whether we're talking about a nation or a church or some other kind of organization for that matter. Every individual capable of making a choice, who by receiving the ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper becomes connected with the church, engages to accept its privileges and to perform its duties. Look at Ezekiel 44:9.
Ezekiel 44, verse 9. Thus saith the Lord God, no stranger, uncircumcised in heart or uncircumcised in flesh, shall enter into my sanctuary of any stranger that is among the children of Israel.
Yeah, notice there the prophet talks about being uncircumcised in heart and in flesh. Right? In other words, your mind, your disposition, the assumption is you receive that outward sign. Why? Because you are acceding to the privileges and obligations of that corporate social society. All that is incumbent on each member of the church then devolves on each of her members. Look at Exodus 12, 2 to 7.
Exodus 12, verses 2 through 7. This month shall be unto you the beginning of months, shall be the first month of the year to you. Speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the tenth day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for an house. And if the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. Your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. You shall take it out from the sheep or from the goats, and you shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month. The whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. And they shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper door posts of the houses wherein they shall eat it.
Yeah, so this is a duty commensurate. It pertains to the whole congregation of Israel. And that means that it is incumbent on every member of the whole congregation of Israel. Right? That duty devolves on each member. It's a common duty. Common duty means it belongs to everyone. They're going to do it. The obligations then that bind the church may have been conferred ages before, as we see in Ezekiel 45:21.
Ezekiel 45, verse 21. In the first month, in the 14th day of the month, you shall have the Passover, a feast of 7 days. Unleavened bread shall be eaten.
Right. When a person makes his profession, even then, by his own act, they descend upon him. Get Genesis 34, 22 to 24.
Genesis 34, 22 to 24. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us be circumcised as they are circumcised, shall not their cattle and their substance and every beast of theirs be ours? Only let us consent unto them, and they will dwell with us. And unto Haran and unto Shechem his son hearken all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised, all that went out of the gate of the city.
Yeah, and you may remember the story of Dinah and her being defiled by the Gentile. So Simeon and Levi go to them and say, look, our sister can't be married to an uncircumcised heathen. So they discuss it, and they decide that they're going to come under the obligations and promises of the covenant. And they circumcise themselves with that in mind. And then, which means they're taking it upon themselves. And that's a right thing for them to do. They no sooner do that, and while they're sore, we're told later that Simeon and Levi descend upon them and kill them all. And God curses them for that. Because those guys had now presumably entered into covenant. And they had no right to kill them in the covenant of God. It's a different point, and I don't want to get bogged down in it, but what they did was a covenant violation. What these men did in taking upon themselves is exactly what all do. All who accede, all who enter in, all who make profession, these obligations descend upon them. All right. Before making his solemn acknowledgement, such a person was under obligation to become connected with the church. And everyone outside of the church is under an obligation to become connected with the church. And there are evils that are threatened against those who are far from God, which are hung over them. Look at Ephesians 2:11-12.
Ephesians 2:11-12. Wherefore remember that ye being in time past Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision, by that which is called the circumcision of the flesh made by hands, that at that time ye were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world.
Yeah, but by entering the communion of the church, those who were formerly heathens become an integral part of her society, and whatever advantage or responsibility attaches to membership within her is extended to those who enter in. Look at
Ephesians 2:13. But now in Christ Jesus, ye who sometimes were far off are made nigh by the blood of Christ.
So, before you are in covenant with God, you're outside of the church, you're aliens to the commonwealth, you are existing in the realm of God's judgment. God's curse is hanging over you. When you enter in, when you accede to, when you join yourself to the society, the church, the communion of the church, you not only are entering into the privileges of that body, you are also taking to yourself the responsibilities or the obligations of the body. And so then to refuse to do it, once you've taken upon yourself that responsibility, will make you additionally culpable. It does make you culpable now, and it will make you even more culpable on Judgment Day. Right, the children of church members are members of the church and are therefore under obligation. Genesis 17:10.
Genesis 17:10. This is my covenant which ye shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised.
Yeah, there's an obligation. If you're born into the church, The obligations are already there. The privileges are there. The obligations are there. That's why we baptize infants. Because of their relation to their parents, children are in possession of the peculiar privileges of the families to which they belong. Psalm 115, 14 and 15.
Psalm 115, verses 14 and 15. The Lord shall increase you more and more, you and your children. You are blessed of the Lord, which made heaven and earth.
And they're to perform the duties of these, but they're under obligation. Look at Genesis 17, 11 to 14.
Genesis 17, verses 11 to 14. And you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you, every man-child in your generations. He that is born in the house or bought with money of any stranger which is not of thy seed. He that is born in thy house, and he that is bought with thy money, must needs be circumcised. And my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised man-child, whose flesh of his foreskin is not circumcised, that soul shall be cut off from his people. He hath broken my covenant.
Yeah, so again, you can enter into the covenant by profession or acceding to the society, the communion of the church, or if you're born of one or both parents who are in the communion of the church, then you are automatically taken into that. And this principle, by the way, applies as well if you have a Christian magistrate. And it is, I think, these considerations here are considerations for what have been called a national baptism, that you have a right to baptism in a nation where you have a chief magistrate who is a member of the church, and where the church is established by law. You have a national establishment of the true church. In that situation, then everyone born in that nation is, in a sense, born in the house of a believer. So, here again, we see that the covenant has privilege, but it also extends through duties. It is implying duties. There are obligations which come from this. Right. Let's move on to the fourth point here, and that is because social covenanting approved in Scripture, that is the kind of social covenanting approved in Scripture, that which is biblical, conferred descending obligation. so we know that it conferred obligation because we know that the promise is descending along these covenant lines. Look at Acts 3, 25 and 26.
Acts 3, verses 25 and 26. Ye are the children of the prophets, and of the covenant which God made with our fathers, saying unto Abraham, and in thy seed shall all the kindreds of the earth be blessed. Unto you first, God, having raised up his son Jesus, sent him to bless you, and turning away every one of you from his iniquities.
So there's a promise there that descends. Why? Because the covenant descends. And if the covenant descends, we've already said covenants, by their nature, and we'll reiterate this again next week, I'm sure, but covenants by their nature entail obligation. And so if we see them conferring promise, covenant promise descending, then we know that covenant obligation has also descended with that promise. Right? And for the reasons we talked about. Okay, the church is one. The social character of the church. The fact that those covenants were made with the express assumption that posterity was taken into them. So Abimelech required Abraham to enter into a covenant with him, which the patriarch would keep, not dealing falsely with himself, nor with his son, nor with his son's son, which when ratified by oath bound all those specified in the covenant.
Genesis 21:23. Now therefore swear unto me here by God that thou wilt not deal falsely with me, nor with my son, nor with my son's son, but according to the kindness that I have done unto thee, thou shalt do unto me and to the land wherein thou hast sojourned.
Abimelech is looking forward, right, and saying, huh, I want to make sure this is understood. I am covenanting with you, and I want you to understand that I expect it to take in descending obligation, subsequent generations, my sons, my son's sons, and so on. But this is the way people covenant, because he can foresee that the problem that he's trying to remedy with his covenant that could persist if this covenant is not, in fact, enforced to subsequent generations. By oath, the children of Israel made with Joseph a covenant by which their descendants, in fulfilling it, acknowledged themselves as engaged to carry up his bones from Egypt. And we read that in Genesis at the very beginning. Now look at what they did in Exodus 13:19.
Exodus 13:19, and Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones away hence with you.
Right, so what are they doing? Moses is explicitly mentioned here as being very circumspect in making sure that this covenant was kept. Why? If covenants don't or can't bind, you know, there has been, over the years, there's been this argument on the part of libertarians, primarily, whether or not previous generations can bind subsequent generations. And this has to do with all kinds of things, such as, among other things, repudiating national debts. Libertarianism, political libertarianism, is a denial. It's rooted in a denial of this truth about descending obligation of covenants. And it's corrupt because of that. It is, in fact, the quickest way to cut people free from not simply duty, but also from privilege. Right, the covenant made by Joshua and the princes of the congregation of Israel with the Gibeonites was kept by the descendants of both parties until there was a breach of it by Saul, upon which followed tokens of divine displeasure. You see this if we compare Joshua 9:15 with 2 Samuel 21:1-2.
Joshua 9, verse 15, And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live, and the princes of the congregation swear unto them.
2 Samuel 21, verses 1 and 2, Then there was a famine in the days of David 3 years, year after year, and David inquired of the Lord. And the Lord answered, "It is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites." And the king called the Gibeonites and said unto them, now the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah.
So, what is happening? God is angry with Israel because some 400 years after Joshua made a compact, a league, a covenant with Gibeon, the Gibeonites, Saul breaks it. By the way, the punishment doesn't even come in Saul's generation. It comes under David. But when the Bible assigns the reason, it's because of what Saul did. And so we can see that breach of covenant, we can see there is a descending obligation of covenant. We can also see that breach of covenant is not necessarily going to be punished in the generation breaking it. It's a special gift, and there's actually something, I think, somewhat poetical in allowing your descendants to be punished for your breach of covenant. Because what you denied in breaking the covenant was that there was any descending obligation of covenant. So by punishing covenant, treachery of covenant in subsequent generations, God is actually reinforcing the idea that covenant obligation does descend. Right, fifth. Let's move on to the fifth point. Because the ends of such covenants may not be attained during the existence on earth of those who entered into them. Look, for example, at Acts 7, 15 and 16.
Acts 7, verses 15 and 16. So Jacob went down into Egypt and died, he and our fathers, and were carried over into Sychem and laid in the sepulcher that Abraham bought for a sum of money of the sons of Emor, the father of Sychem.
Yeah, so who's he talking about there? Stephen is rehearsing, among other things, in that the disposition of the bones of Joseph, right? They come down into Egypt. Joseph dies. Could the generation that swore the covenant, could they possibly have fulfilled the obligation? No. And it's for this very reason, then, that we have the conferring of covenant obligation, descending obligation of covenants. Nothing, in fact, is more common in the providence of God than for one to begin and another to finish. Look at John 2:20.
John 2, verse 20. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days?
Yeah. 46 years the temple was being built. You think one generation built that? No. Very clearly it was more than one generation. Somebody had to begin. Somebody finished it. In fact, this story is something in the last 15 or 20 years, they just finished a cathedral, I believe, in New York City that they began 100 years ago. And in Europe, there are cathedrals that took them centuries to build. Somebody began that. Well, in like manner, the work, the real work of the church begins, but is it all accomplished in the generation that begins it? In fact, very seldom is that the case. You know, I would love to see that to be the case. I would love to see this generation actually complete something. The work which God gives countenance to some to undertake, according to his own good pleasure, he commits to others. So look at Joshua 1, 1 and 2.
Joshua 1, verses 1 and 2. Now after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, came to pass that the Lord spake unto to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, unto the land which I do give to them, even to the children of Israel.
Yeah, so Moses dies. Does God call off the whole plan? Not at all. Just another day in the unfolding of God's elaborate plan regarding the redemption of his elect people and his augmentation of his declarative glory. Okay, Moses dies and Joshua picks up the baton. And it's time for him to run with it for a while. God brings one servant to the grave and he raises up another one to take, you know, to continue the work. The schemes of reformation set on foot by his servants, he acknowledges. And when he will, they're enabled to complete them. Otherwise, they're wound up by others. Psalm 48, 12 and 13.
Psalm 48, verses 12 and 13. Talk about Zion and go round about her. Tell the towers thereof. Mark ye well her bulwarks. Consider her palaces that ye may tell it to the generation following.
The reason God would have us to, in each generation, to walk about Zion, to consider her palaces, consider, meditate upon where the church is in your age. Why? You have something to tell the generation following. You know, you need to tell them where you found it and where you left it. Was it in a state of disrepair? Did you do anything to help? Did you just let it go? Did you make it worse? You have to tell the generation following something. And sadly, when generation following reads most of the garbage that's been published in the last 100 years, they'll know what a sad condition the church has been left in of recent. To resolve to use means to bring the church to a state of excellence, which according to the promise of God, she will yet come on earth. We're talking about the millennium. That is obligatory on them who fear him. Look at Isaiah 8, 16.
Isaiah 8, 16. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples.
Bind up the testimony, and seal the law among my disciples. If you use means, one means, a great means the church uses to advance the Reformation, to press toward that latter-day glory, is to bind up the testimony, testimony-bearing. While this is not a place where I want to deal with that as a separate issue, it is important to understand the church has a duty not simply to confess the truth, but to bear testimony against everything contrary to that truth. It's not a sentiment that sits well with postmodern thinking, but it is necessary. To vow to use those means, they are under obligation. Look at Psalm 76, 11.
Psalm 76, verse 11. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared.
So, in order to bear testimony, to maintain testimony, we are to vow. And then, if we're going to vow, again, what must we do? We have to fulfill it. Why are we doing all of this? Because the ends for which the church has covenanted are ends which presume subsequent generations. One generation coming and then passing away, and another one rising up to take up the work, all to fulfill the ends contemplated in these covenants the church has taken. The removal of his servants from this work does not manifest their Lord's displeasure at them, but his intention to bestow upon them a gracious reward. Look at Revelation 14:13.
Revelation 14:13, and I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow them.
And it falls to others to undertake that work which is yet unfulfilled. John 4:38.
John 4:38. I sent ye to reap that whereon ye bestowed no labor. Other men labored, and ye are entered into their labors.
But Jesus acknowledges that there is this generational work going on. And so the church engages in testimony bearing precisely because the ends contemplated in its covenants and its obligations, they're going to take more than just this present generation or some previous then present generation to fulfill. All right. Sixth, because the people of God, even themselves, are bound by interior engagements of his church. Jeremiah 50:5.
Jeremiah 50:5. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten.
So, descending obligation of covenants, because the people of God from time to time have bound themselves with anterior, by anterior covenants, engagements of his church. Right? They're bounded by them. That everlasting covenant is a covenant which bound them before they were born, and yet they're taking hold of it and again renewing that bond. Thus, in the land of Moab, Moses addresses many regarding a covenant obligation engaged before their birth. Look at Deuteronomy 5:2-3 again.
Deuteronomy 5:2-3. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day.
And additionally, several scriptures have the saints acknowledging themselves as included in the covenant made with Abraham, and consequently under its obligations. So let's look at Psalm 47:9, Isaiah 63:16. Luke 1:72-74, and Galatians 3:7.
Psalm 47:9. The princes of the people are gathered together, even the people of God, the God of Abraham, for the shields of the earth belong unto God, he is greatly exalted.
Isaiah 63:16. Doubtless thou art our father, though Abraham be ignorant of us, and Israel acknowledge us not. Thou, O Lord, art our Father, our Redeemer. Thy name is from everlasting.
Luke 1:72-74. To perform the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath which he sware to our father Abraham, that he would grant unto us, that we, being delivered out of the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear.
Galatians 3:7. Know ye therefore that they which are of faith, the same are the children of Abraham.
So what is being said again and again, Old and New Testament? There's an acknowledgement that this covenant made with Abraham is binding on subsequent generations. The covenant that Abraham made with God is binding, and that they are bound, and there is an obligation bound up with that. In fact, we would say that, you know, again and again, these other covenants that are being made by Moses and by Joshua and by the kings, they're all actually renewing the same covenant. All that they're doing is they are tailoring the language to their time and circumstance. But they're always upholding that covenant. To the extent that their circumstances are the same, then there's no reason for changing the language. And so they're acknowledging Abraham, Abraham, Abraham. By a prophet of the Lord, Israel are exhibited as recognizing themselves to have been represented in the covenant transactions at Bethel. In Hosea 12, verse 4.
Yea, he had power over the angel and prevailed. He wept and made supplication unto him. He found him in Bethel, and there he spake with us.
He spake with us. And Hosea is saying that when Jacob is wrestling with the angel in Bethel and makes a covenant with God, that when the angel, when God speaks to Jacob, that he's not just speaking to Jacob, he's speaking to those who were there with Hosea at that time. That's going back to that principle we talked about earlier. They're certainly contemplated in that covenant. Likewise, the words of Peter make this interest clear in Acts 2, verse 39.
For the promise is unto you and to your children, and to all that are afar off, even as many as the Lord our God shall call.
Yeah, again, what do we see? We see Peter talking about descending promise, covenant promise. And that implies descending obligation. It's expressing the same sentiment that their fathers had entered into covenant obligations with God in which they were recognized, of which Moses and all Israel sing in Exodus 15:2.
Exodus 15, verse 2. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him in habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him.
Yeah, so again, Moses is singing, but he's singing not as though what they're doing is unrelated. No, it's in fact very much historically grounded in what has gone before them. And he's acknowledging the covenants made with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob, and so on. The psalmist offers praise and language acknowledging explicitly the obligation of obedience that had been transmitted by the deeds of parents or ancestors to God's service. If we look at Psalm 116:16-18.
Psalm 116:16-18. O Lord, truly I am thy servant, I am thy servant, and the son of thy handmaid, thou hast loosed my bonds. I will offer to thee a sacrifice of thanksgiving, and will call upon the name of the Lord. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all his people.
So, the psalmist is saying that and making ground of praise that God, or the people of God, had entered into covenant with him, that they had taken hold of this covenant, that they were under covenant obligation, that this covenant obligation, moreover, had, along with the promises of the covenant, to be sure, but that all of this had descended to them. This obligation was conferred in a manner descending to them when these covenants were made. All right, finally. The last point for tonight. Because the Lord himself always views his church as bound by the covenant engagements thereof, competent to its circumstances, made in all earlier periods. In other words, God always views the church to be bound by those previous covenant engagements. Look at Deuteronomy 4:23 and also Romans 9:4.
Deuteronomy 4:23, take heed unto yourselves, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make you a graven image, or the likeness of anything which the Lord thy God hath forbidden thee.
Romans 9, verse 4, who are Israelites, to whom pertaineth the adoption, and the glory, and the covenants, and the giving of the law, and the service of God, and the promises.
Yeah, so, the Deuteronomy passage, the duties that are called to their attention by Moses are duties which are covenant duties, covenant obligations, bound to them, not simply at the time of Moses, but even going back to at least to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And you'll note that Paul in Romans 9:4 refers to the things that pertain to the Jews, and he says covenants, it's plural. Not just the simply the covenant of grace, but he's talking about all these covenants that they entered into. These all pertain to them. In other words, there's a descending obligation to them. They're bound by those covenant engagements. By the covenant which he made with his servant Abraham, and once and again renewed to him, he held his people bound. Look at Ephesians 2:12.
Ephesians 2, verse 12, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world.
Yeah, and strangers from the covenants of promise. Again, that plural, the people who are outside of Israel are strangers to what? To the covenant made with Abraham and all that subsequent covenanting that went on, these covenants. Well, how or why could they be strangers to all of that? We're not just simply talking about the covenant of grace. Yes, they're taking hold of the covenant of grace, but each of these is a covenant renewal, that voluntary assumption of all of those duties, covenant duties, the obligations of covenant. They're all there. Promises are there, to be sure, and along with them, our covenant obligations. Thus, in the ratification of his covenant with Abraham, there was a lamp of fire, which is an emblem of God's covenant presence, and a smoking furnace, symbolizing the trial of the people of Israel in the iron furnace of Egyptian affliction. Look at Deuteronomy 4:20.
Deuteronomy 4:20. But the Lord hath taken you and brought you forth out of the iron furnace, even out of Egypt, to be unto him a people of inheritance, as you are this day.
Yeah, because although the people were not yet born, the fact is they were present in Abraham as a covenant head. Right, look at Genesis 15:8-12, and then 17 and 18.
Genesis 15:8-12. And he said, Lord God, whereby shall I know that I shall inherit it? And he said unto him, take me an heifer of 3 years old, and a she-goat of 3 years old, and a ram of 3 years old, and a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he took unto him all these, and divided them in the midst, and laid each piece one against another. But the birds divided he not. And when the fowls came down upon the carcasses, Abram drove them away. Verse 12. And when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and lo, an horror of great darkness fell upon him. And then verses 17 and 18. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. In that same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, and to thy seed have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates.
Yeah, so I alluded to this earlier, but when God made the covenant with Abraham, he told them in that covenant that they would be put for a time in this iron furnace of affliction in Egypt before they would be brought to the promised land. But that nonetheless, it would happen. So long before a generation was born that went into Egypt even, God, in making this covenant, tells them that this is going to happen. So they're all contemplated. All these subsequent generations are contemplated already in the covenant as it's made with Abraham. Right? What is done at Sinai when as a nation they receive the code, the Mosaic code, as a nation, all of that was already covenanted in Abraham. So sending obligation of covenants is simply the way God has made things to work. The covenant the Lord kept with the whole house of Israel, even as if they had all of them been then present, that covenant is alluded to in Nehemiah 9, 7 and 8.
Nehemiah 9, verses 7 and 8. Thou art the Lord, the God who didst choose Abram and brought us forth out of Ur of the Chaldees, and gavest him the name of Abraham, and foundest his heart faithful before thee, and madest a covenant with him to give the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, and the Jebusites, and the Girgashites, to give it, I say, to his seed, and hast performed thy words, for thou art righteous.
Yeah, so that covenant that he's kept with the whole house of Israel, it's spoken of there as if all had been present when it was made. And that's in Nehemiah's day. This is centuries later. And again, there is in every lawful covenant a presumption of descending obligation. It confers obligation until such time as the ends contemplated have been fulfilled, or until one or both parties have been dissolved. The duties of the covenant then, as if all Israel had been before him when it was made, he enjoined on them. Genesis 17:9.
And God said unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant therefore, thou and thy seed after thee and their generations.
It's enjoined, right, just as much as he, in making this covenant with Abraham, he is foreseeing or forecasting, really, the future of Israel. He makes it with Abraham, but in Abraham he's making with all who are going to be descendants of him. And that implies obligation. Moreover, he commands all to keep his covenant as made, not merely with his people at any given period, but as entered into by the faithful who went before them. Psalm 111:9.
He sent redemption unto his people. He hath commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name.
He's commanded his covenant forever. Well, that means really that not only is he talking about the durability of the covenant, but you have to understand that means that there's a descending obligation, because there's a conferring of obligation. And that conferred obligation must descend. A covenant which is being commanded forever, that means there's plenty to do between the creation and judgment day. It's manifest then that a covenant with God should be kept by those who make it, and the duty of covenanting ought not merely be performed throughout every age, but until all the engagements of the people of God made in every period be implemented, they continue to confer obligation on their successors. 1 Chronicles 16:15.
1 Chronicles 16:15. Be mindful always of his covenant, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations.
Yeah, this is going to go on and on until everything has been performed which has been engaged. And by the way, we're going to leave it on this point, but we need to remember, God is angry with and threatens those who keep not the covenants of those who represented them, as if they had broken a covenant with him by themselves. Again, at Jeremiah 11, verses 10 and 11.
Jeremiah 11, verses 10 and 11. They returned back to the iniquities of their forefathers, which refused to hear my words. And they went after other gods to serve them. The house of Israel and the house of Judah have broken my covenant, which I made with their fathers. Therefore, thus saith the Lord, behold, I will bring evil upon them, which they shall not be able to escape. And though they shall cry unto me, I will not hearken unto them.
Yeah, the fact is that covenant, breach of covenant, is something which God threatens with very serious sanctions. And the sad thing is, very often people are under the sanctions of broken covenant and they don't even know it. So we'll see some of that as we proceed, probably next time. But anyway, next time we're going to try to, as I said, tie up a lot of loose ends, things that we couldn't get into quite as much this time as we finish up the idea of covenanting, conferring obligation.